Good evening, friends. This is your host on Valley Writers Read, Franz Weinschenk, here to welcome you to tonight's program. As you probably know, all the authors who read their stories on our show either currently reside in or used to live in the San Joaquin Valley. That's especially relevant tonight because our author, Anne Marcella, who nowadays spends most of her time in Paris, France, actually grew up in Fresno and graduated from one of our local high schools. Not only that, but her story for us tonight is set right here in our valley. It's about Carmen, who was born in Chile and immigrated to the valley to become a live-in servant for two very wealthy socialite ladies. And though Carmen's job description might include the word servant, she never considers herself inferior or servile. Why, even her bosses acknowledge that she has a great deal of charm and independence. So here now to read the story that Anne Marcella entitles Miss Carmen is Kate McKnight.
Miss Carmen, from the Lost and Found and Other Stories. In Concepcion, Chile, Carmen lived with her seven brothers and sisters. Sometimes she lived in the homes of her sisters, other times in the homes of her brothers. In the United States of America, in the Valley of San Joaquin, she lived in guest bedrooms in the homes of wealthy matrons. In America, wherever she lodged, she had a color television set. This was not so in Chile. She was middle-aged, unmarried, had short, wavy gray hair, as well as a silver-capped front tooth, which she called the beauty tooth. And then there was something one remarked about her cheeks when she smiled, perhaps that they were plum-shaped and nothing more, or else that they overwhelmed her mouth and gave her the look of a dizzy woman. For a time before leaving Chile, she had stayed with her brother Jorge, who had begot three children, including an exquisite daughter named Lupita, who had been crowned Little Miss Concepcion at age of four. Precious Lupita's hair had been dyed yellow for the competition, but as Jorge's wife was a hairdresser, this was carried off quite well. Carmen took meticulous care of the child's clothes, hand-washing them in delicate bleaches and ironing them. In truth, she had been content at the house of Jorge, just as she had been at Juanita's and Carlos's and Pochi's and Victor's and Lima's and Julio's. Only what is contentment to a willful dreamer? So little, indeed. Certainly not enough. Carmen did not possess that arbitrarily extravagant je ne sais quoi common to the poetic soul. She wasn't a fantast in that way. Her dreams never exceeded her want, but were a perfect echo of it. Never had she been falsified by a vision, by an unattainable something. What can be said is that the recurrent image of herself propped on a Louis XIV fauteuil rested vivid in her mind's eye. It was Carmen's cousin Alberta who urged her to come to the Valley of San Joaquin. An affluent matriarch by the name of Mrs. J. M. Walker, for whom Alberta polished silver, was looking for a live-in maid for a part-time work. Alberta thought of Carmen, who had always loved beautiful objects and the luxurious interiors of their homes in Los Ricos y Los Despiadados. She wrote in her letter, "Here the homes are beautiful ones like those in the rich and the pitiless. They can be cleaned with a pinky, so there is very little work to do, and closets filled with fiesta shoes of the mistress. When she is gone, you can put them on and iron this way. Here you will learn the names of things, things you have always wondered about. You will learn the names, and from the laundry you will know the private doings of the mistress and her mister. This would please you, would it not?" Carmen thought about it. This proposition did appeal to her. She saw the hitherto closed hand of opportunity open, offering its palm to her as a crossing bridge. Leading where? Ah, Carmen could not say. The salary was a handsome one, too, and she insisted on this that she would have a burden. Nevertheless, she was somewhat apprehensive about leaving the milieu of loved ones, the familiar rituals, the concatenation of vowels. She thought of how they must speak in the Valley of San Joaquin, and she feared it was something awful, duck-like, and exasperating. For 2 weeks, Carmen thought this proposition over. It sounded bad, it sounded good. She waited in her right hand, she waited in her left hand. Then one Monday morning at 10 o'clock, she walked down to the bus depot in a black and white checkered dress and bought a ticket. What made her do so? Perhaps she was swayed by a menopausal whim or by the advice of a revenant. It would be hard to say. She announced her decision to leave that night at Jorge's dinner table. Jorge looked at her solemnly and held her by the shoulders with his arms outstretched. He said to her, "You are not my only sister, but you are my only sister who has cared for the clothes of my children. For this, I will miss you." Her farewell was bid in a bon voyage party that lasted 7 days, each of the 7 siblings paying a day of tribute to their sister Carmen. When the festivities were exhausted, Carmen packed 2 suitcases and boarded the bus, the first of many that would take her from Chile to the Valley of San Joaquin. Carmen's journey was a long and difficult one, and is a story in itself. Let it be said that she arrived in the Valley of San Joaquin with a provisory black patch over her left eye. What had happened? She never told. When Mrs. Walker showed Carmen her room, she looked from right to left and said in her language, "It will do." Had Mrs. Walker understood this, she would have been vexed. Carmen, however, did not say this to insult, nor was she being by any means discriminatory. She was simply concerned with what would do. She had never been a landlord and couldn't have understood the vanity of one. Her room was on the first floor and was furnished with a twin chintz-covered bed, matching curtains and a love seat. There was also a small TV sitting on a commode. It should be said that Carmen was an ambitious woman in her own right, and if one were to ask how an aspiring woman could have concerned herself with the clothes of her brother's children, the wash and the wear of them, she would have said, "I have done this out of love." She could do one thing for love and be strongly desirous of another so very different. Clearly there were 2 hearts and 2 minds. She spoke to them in mismatched voices. Carmen was the sort of woman who could divide the family's pots of beans into 16 equal servings. Nobody would feel cheated. In the Valley of San Joaquin, she vividly saw what could be had and would not consider herself a have-not. Often she told Alberta, "The humans are divided into those who have and those who have not, those who take and those who are taken. As this is true, I am one who takes and will have. This is prudence." When she saw the cumbrous jumbo television set in the billiard room, she resented Missy Walkie, as she called her, for her own insignificant one. Once, while she was dusting, she accidentally knocked the volume knob off the jumbo set. She pocketed it. Mrs. Walker was happy enough with Carmen, although she found her a few too many times sitting in an armchair when she should have been waxing or vacuuming. Mostly, she had her cook and serve luncheons and dinner parties. For this, Carmen was given a white doily to wear on her head and a matching apron. As she was awed by decorum and the wearing of uniforms, she found these occasions almost titillating. She smiled demurely at the guests. Her intention was to exhibit the beauty tooth and to seduce them. What this little trick got her was several jobs moonlighting outside the domain of Missy Walkie. For one, there was Missy Smithy, president of the Junior League, who hired her to serve at her daughter's wedding reception. Carmen passed out dishes of relish on silver trays. Yes, she was quite skilled at this. She could walk up to anyone of any disposition, offer an hors d'oeuvre. Her Latina gait, that slow, indolent sway of the hips, was curious to some. It irritated and enticed in the same way as her smile. There was something puerile and almost sly about her, something that either coaxed a citizen of the Valley of San Joaquin or made him wary. She held out the tray and said, "You wanty?" Carmen didn't pay taxes. She really was doing quite well and opened a savings account. She had easily procured more and more jobs for herself and could afford to refuse an offer if it reeked of the difficile, as she said. Her specialty was catering. She loved the gala events. She abandoned Missy Walkie's doily for an oversized white bow that she clipped on the top of her head. She had a black mock evening gown, hem to knee length, that she put on for catering. On her feet, she wore white ballerina slippers. Shrewd as she was, Carmen managed to delegate the work to the help and arranged it so that her participation in the cleanups was minimal. "Go do cakey," she might say, and the others would cut and serve the cake. "Washy dishy," and the others would wash. It never occurred to Carmen that she couldn't speak English. She was understood, and she misunderstood when it was necessary. After 3 years or so of industrious living in the valley of San Joaquin, Carmen saw the many seeds she had sown flower into nameable things, some of which she could wear, some of which she could tap. She had acquired much, including the jumbo set she had eyed and modestly vandalized in Missy Walkie's house. But there was one seed she had not thought of planting, perhaps because she knew how it could and had thrived, or because it had once been common enough to her. That one was the seed of the heart. Time and again, Carmen had tried to entice her brothers and sisters to come settle in the Valley of San Joaquin with her. She had even made a down payment on a 2-bedroom house for her brother Jorge and his wife and children. But Jorge was kept in Chile by several dubious mining investments. The others all had one excuse or another not to join her. Carmen eventually gave up on the idea altogether, and for a while was angry and sent vindictive letters boasting of her successes and threatening to disown them. But had she ever owned them? She asked herself this and felt merciless, as she tread alone in a world without mercy. Grace! When was the last time she felt the luminosity of it in her body? Hope? Things sufficed and the jaded soul didn't search it. Charity? She fed the pigeons! Carmen was not a woman to plead. I'm lonely in the valley of San Joaquin. Such a confession would either have cured or worsened her spiritual disarray. She took a middle ground instead and was childishly bilious. She overpeppered luncheon consommés and mistreated ladylike palates. She loaded the dishwasher with crystal. Missy Walkie suffered the losses. Carmen was cavalier and ornery with the peerage. On Thanksgiving, she stuffed Missy Walkie's turkey with a fiery mole filling. The family was aghast, although some were proud and feeble-minded enough to eat it, only to be all the more miserable with gastric fever the following day. After this, Missy Walkie dismissed Carmen, giving her 3 days to prepare her departure. She could not forgive the enmity of blunders, and Carmen offered no apologies. Carmen was proud, but she was also a taker. Her pride, then, was merely a convenient peccadillo, a vanity that kept her on the desirous side of humanity. It in no way hindered her propensity to help herself, nor did the rift with Mrs. Walker preclude her from finding another refuge in the milieu. Carmen had someone in mind when she left, the widow of a ranchero tycoon from Spain, Señora Valdez. Señora Valdez herself was not Spanish. She was from a southern state and immigrated to the Valley of San Joaquin as the result of a dust storm. She met the Señor Valdez at the Raisin Ball and made a fruitful marriage. She needed someone to do vegetables and linens, as she put it, and on several occasions she offered Carmen her guest house in exchange for kitchen help. Carmen did not call her up, as she never used the phone, but walked there. She lived 7 blocks down from Mrs. Walker on the same street. It was an easy walk for a robust woman like Carmen, and when she got to the house of Señora Valdez, there were some 20 cars parked around it. Señora Valdez was entertaining. Carmen was intent on her predicament and didn't hesitate to walk through the gate and into the backyard where the cocktail party was in full swing. Señora Valdez, a flamboyant blonde with an imperious nose, was holding a high ball and laughing, her head thrown back. Surrounding her were several dashing gentlemen looking bemused in summer suits. Although Carmen spotted her straight off, she made a stop at the hors d'oeuvre table first. She was famished. After having a few bites, she walked up to Señora Valdez from behind and tapped her on the shoulder. The woman reeled around and saw her there with a white bow in her head. "It's Missy Carmy!" she let out for others' amusement. The woman was lit. Then, calming a bit, but with the same condescending tone, she asked her, "Carmen, what can we do for you? Are you here for the party?" Carmen ignored this mockery and kept to what she knew best, not self-righteousness, but seduction. She smiled coyly at Señora Valdez and bared the beauty tooth. "Missy Carmy not at casa Missy Walkie more. She do kitchen for Señora and live in house?" "Oh, God, the vegetables. That's right. Got to have someone do the vegetables. You know that Costa Rican girl I had just left last month, left with the neighbor's gardener. She told me he had his stomach tied. You know, he was fat. F-A-T. I said to her, 'Juanita, if those tubes come untied, you got yourself a lard ass.' But she left with him. I just got a letter from her in Mexico. She was such a sweet thing. And you know, she just loved me. She kept herself so clean, so clean." She took another sip of her highball and narrowed in on Carmen, a bit too severely, as was her way. "Okay, Carmen, but you know how I like them done. And here she demonstrated with her hands as if pulling threads. Julienne, like they do in Paris. Julienne. Then an expansive woman in a green mousseline dress appeared and took Signora Valdez by the arm, claiming that she hadn't seen her in ages. Carmen left and went into the kitchen, where a heavy-legged woman named Fanny was slowly decorating a platter of Armenian delicacies. Carmen swiftly took the platter from her and went back out to the garden. She wove her way through the guests, serving and seducing them, not with her sex appeal, for this she took to heart and saved for her people, but with her quaintness, her bow, and her accent. Those were her gimcracks, and she arranged them most successfully. Late that night, when the company finally left, Signora Valdez, in her après-soirée stupor, handed Carmen the keys to the guest house. Carmen found the bed and slept till 10 o'clock the next day. Working for Signora Valdez suited Carmen, as it was essentially a morning job, and left her afternoons free for going to the shopping malls or watching soap operas. Signora, however, was a difficult, exigent woman who impatiently repeated herself and demanded perfection from her entourage. She was a Catholic, though, unlike the other matrons for whom Carmen had worked. At least she wouldn't have to think of her as a heretic. Every Sunday, Signora took Carmen to Mass with her at Our Lady of Victory. Carmen usually would take the bus home from the church, as she liked to stay after and play bingo with the Las Mujeres de Salvador Guild. She never risked befriending anybody in the group. She was afraid she might be asked for something. Carmen was fundamentally clannish. Had one of the women been from the same village as she, then perhaps she would have extended a hand and opened her breast in intimacy. But then again, maybe not. For Carmen, there had always been family and others, never a friend, never a foe. Her relation to either group went unquestioned. To one, she was inextricably joined by blood and obligation, and the other she observed indifferently, like the cat that sniffs at its dinner only to walk away and then come back later to nibble disdainfully at it. Carmen fed off others, and with a sense of duty, which for her was love, fed family and family only. The most wonderful thing about the house of Signora Valdez was, to Carmen's mind, the opulent selection of armchairs in the formal living room. One of them was a faux Louis XIV, so like the one she had envisioned for many years. Yes, she thought to herself, it is this one. How stunning it was, how ravishingly fine in every way. Carmen was benumbed at the sight of it. She was overwhelmed by the beauty of the object, by the rich persimmon color of its upholstery. The chair itself sat in a posture so ingeniously conceived. It sat formidable and beckoning in a corner of the elegant salon. For weeks, Carmen would go into the living room to gaze at it. Everything about it was sublime, and as she looked at it, both ardor and despair welled in her. She moaned and pulled at her pantyhose and hugged herself as if protecting a child at the breast. It so happened that one evening Signora Valdez asked Carmen to stay in the house while she was gone. She was going to a gala at the country club, and as her neighbor had just been robbed the previous night, she was worried about leaving the house empty. Carmen agreed to do this. Signora Valdez had 4 TVs and an icebox filled with Belgian chocolates and French pastries. So Carmen took her knitting with her into the house, bid Signora goodbye, and locked the doors behind her. She sat in the kitchen for a time and watched the Channel 21 news. She helped herself to soda pops and chocolates, and then she decided to go to the bathroom. She just loved the bathrooms of Signora Valdez, which were plush with floor-to-ceiling mirrors, marble countertops, and gold faucets. They were very different from the sober ones in Missy Walkie's house. This was because Signora was a Catholic and the other was not. That was how Carmen saw it. To get to the bathroom, she had to pass through the living room, and it was in doing so that she stopped short in her tracks. In fact, nothing impeded her physically from going on. Yet there was an incandescent stillness in the room that defied a trespasser, that belittled the need to get from one point to another, a silence that said to itself, to the intruder, "Silencio, por favor!" It was as if the dim light of the room were issued from a singular dream hole, and as if this dream hole had been carved above the objet d'art to illuminate it. The rest of the room was left in the glow of its wake. It was a brazen jewel, the color of a stone unheard of and never seen. Carmen's mouth watered. It was a fruit of ecstatic flavors unknown to the tongue. She craved and ached for it. Carmen stood in the middle of the room, her eyes riveted upon the fauteuil. But it was not her eyes that perceived the chair's beckoning. What registered this were the cords of her body, her yearning instinct. Carmen went to the armchair, solemnly with her head tilted upward, and sat upon it transfixed. And at once she fell into reverie so vivid and fiery, a reverie of carnal delights and dignity balls, of sumptuous banquets and courtesans. She dreamed of what was wicked and splendid, here of the sublime, there of the abject. It was an amalgam of slothful postures and pristine comportments. Did she want all this? God knows. Carmen surpassed herself. For the first time in her life, perhaps, she surpassed herself. As it turned out, Signora was a good deal deaf and asked Carmen to answer the phone when she was in the house doing vegetables and linens. This didn't please her a bit, and when she answered, she said, "Hola." She was curt on the phone. Some day she unplugged all of Signora's phones for her own peace of mind. Usually Signora didn't notice. She spent her mornings in the beauty shop in any case. The voices on the line were always the same to Carmen. They were nagging ones, asking things of her she found unbecoming and didn't care to understand. One day, however, when she answered the phone, the voice she heard was not a Valley of San Joaquin voice, but one kindred to her own. It was a man, and she immediately addressed him in Spanish. "If you want the Señora Valdez, she is not here. If you know her, then you know that she is at the beauty shop every morning until 12. At 12, she comes home and has a dietetic lunch, which I weigh on the scale for her. Then she naps until 3. She does not take calls before 3. She doesn't call back, so you needn't leave a message." Carmen was able to say what she had wanted to say many a time, and this was a great relief to her. "Tell her that the foreman of the ranch has called. She knows me by my first name. I am Manuel, the ranch foreman. Tell her that I will be by at 4 o'clock with 5 legs of lamb, bread that I baked in the ground, and 6 crates of seedless grapes. There's business I must do with her." "I will tell her this." But Carmen forgot to tell Signora, and when the foreman drove up in his truck, the woman was still in her naptime negligee. Carmen was sent out to stall him until the other could make herself decent. Manuel was a heavy-set man, florid in the face and with a square Spanish brow. He had several boxes of grapes in his arms when Carmen greeted him. She had a bow on top of her head and had put on a scoop-neck sundress that flatteringly revealed her embonpoint. "Hello," she said through the beauty tooth. "You can set those down in the kitchen. Come this way." She led him through several gates and then back through the back door into the kitchen. The man put them down on a counter with a grunt and went back out to get the rest of what he had brought. Carmen followed him. "I would help you, but I am not meant to carry heavy things. I am not a housekeeper who pushes vacuums and overturns sofas. I do vegetables and linens only. I live in the guest house next to the pool. Where do you live?" Carmen watched his back as he lifted the heavy burlap sacks of lamb out of the truck. She watched the strength of his arms and his back and his squatty legs as he swiftly delivered his goods, one and then the next, into the kitchen. She watched him intently and pondered. He reminded her of something, something she hadn't seen in many years, it seemed. Yes, he reminded her of a man. He was a man. She was giddy. Had things become such that she had forgotten? What about all those men she served finger foods to at the galas? Clearly they were different from this one. They were another something. This manual laborer, this Manuel clad in ranchero wear, was a man, like those she had left behind her in Las Pampas. Carmen shuddered. "I live in the foreman's house on a hill above the ranch. It has 2 bathrooms and 2 bedrooms. There is a living room with a very big window. It gives on to the Valley of San Joaquin like you have never seen her before. She's not a greedy valley, but she is a mean one." Carmen said no more, nor did he. Signora Valdez walked in and effusively greeted the foreman, kissing him on both cheeks as she had seen her late husband's people do. He was a simple man, as they say, and this sort of theatrics embarrassed him. His face turned almost purple. Carmen quietly left them and went back to the guest house. There she lay down on her back and thought of the man. What Signora and Manuel spoke of, in part, was Signora's own garden. She asked Manuel to pick the grapes that hung ripe and abundantly from her trellis. The birds were making a mess of them, and she needed it taken care of right away. She also asked him to pick the peach trees, of which there were 6. Manuel agreed to do so the following week. Carmen was in the kitchen cleaning leeks when she saw him through the window walking into the backyard with burlap and canvas paraphernalia and cutters in hand. Then he went into the tool shed and brought out a ladder. Setting it underneath the vineyard trellis, he began clipping off the grapes. For several hours she watched him as he cleaned, peeled, sliced, and diced. She imagined herself the fruit in his hands, in the hands of Manuel. She saw that they were strong and held much of life. They were indiscriminate hands, and for this Carmen wanted to kiss them, because such hands were the finest, but were never the rewarded. They were hardly loved appropriately. It was a scorchingly hot day, but Manuel did not take off his shirt. He was in the garden of an Anglo-Saxon and didn't forget this. When the signora came home, she waved hello to Manuel and proceeded into the kitchen for the dietetic lunch. She asked Carmen to make some sandwiches for Manuel. Carmen made a copious lunch platter for him with 2 roast beef sandwiches, potato salad, 3 bean salad, corn on the cob, and chips. For a dessert, she would later give him a fudgesicle. She also gave him 2 beers and sparkling water. She set all this on a tray and carried it out to him. "Lunch!" she called out. Manuel looked up a bit stunned, as a man who forgets his hunger and work until he is reminded of it, and came down from the ladder. Carmen set the tray down on the table and waited. Manuel took off the burlap bags, heavy with grapes, he had been wearing, and wiped his hands with a handkerchief. Then he sat down to eat. He looked briefly at Carmen and said, "Gracias," nodding his head. Carmen took this as an invitation to sit down at the table. Manuel was very hungry indeed and ate greedily. Carmen thought of the roast beef sandwiches she made. She had put horseradish on them and was glad at that moment for having done so. "He is a caballero," she said to herself. She could see that he took pleasure in eating like a wolf and did not speak to him. Carmen watched him, and had he had not such an appetite, he might have noticed this. As it was, he was seemingly unaware of her presence, or at least undisturbed by it. When he was at last finished, he pushed the tray away from him and sat back in his chair. He rested his hands on his belly and began to speak, perhaps to Carmen, but most likely not. "A man can live alone with sheep and vineyards for many years, and then one day it will not be enough. He can build his own house with the fruits of his labors, and this will not be enough. A man can invent a machine, and this, too, will not be enough." "Yes," said Carmen, although she didn't understand him, really. "A man," he went on, "wears pants, a shirt, suspenders, and shoes. A caballero wears a hat. Still, this is not enough. A man is judged on these things that are not enough. They are nothing. There are very few honest men. But even an honest man is not enough." Carmen was beginning to fathom his words and wanted to say to him, "I am enough, I am." She wanted to assuage that misery in him, the sadness that made him say that all that he was and had was not enough. She wondered how he could say such things when everything was at his feet, when everything that was enough. It was. And there she was, his angel of mercy. "See me, see me," she wanted to cry out. "For the love of you, I am enough." But Manuel didn't see her. He stood back up, loaded himself with burlap sacks, and climbed the ladder. Manuel came 3 more times that week, and each time Carmen fixed him a lunch and watched him eat it. And after each lunch, he would lean back and speak of regret and sorrow in a way that excluded Carmen, that fixed her as a voiceless listener. How she wanted to say, "You are missing me while I sit in front of you," but could not. His way tied her throat in a knot. It was only at night under the same trellis that the knot worked itself free, and Carmen was given to monologue so tiresome, so depleting, that several times she finished the evening curled up under a peach tree. After Manuel finished his work at Signora's, there was no sign of him, although Carmen longed desperately for one. She no longer unplugged the phone, but nervously picked it up when it rang, hoping to hear his voice on the line. Often she pictured him in front of the big window he had spoken of, looking out at the valley of San Joaquin, which was mean and beautiful, but not enough, and she wept for his sorrow, which was hers. That was enough for her. Perhaps the only respite she had from her pining was the fauteuil. The armchair had become for her not simply an object, but a phenomenon and a haven. She sat in it once or twice a day, careful to know the whereabouts of the signora when she did so. And in the chair she gave herself up to the most delicious of reveries, sometimes elaborately baroque, other times serene and windless. It was true that there were days more hope-filled than others for Carmen. On these more inspired mornings she rose from bed with a good faith that there would be news of her beloved. She took a naive pleasure in such mornings, but was left by the end of the day in a state of utter want, all the more desperate and dispirited. Carmen frequented the armchair often, and usually at 1 o'clock, when the signora spoke on the kitchen phone with her best friend Trudy. It was in the month of October, 2 months after Manuel had left and had not come back. While sitting in the Louis XIV, she had a fleeting vision. In this vision, she was wrapped in scarlet drapes and carried by birds through the sky. She was being taken back to her homeland, to the alluvial plains of Biobío. Everything appeared so quaint below her, she laughed. Her laughter sounded like tinkling bells. The birds brought her to a green mountain, one she had seen in her childhood. Only it had been carved into a castle. The birds left her at the door of it, and she stood there regally for a moment, draped in crimson. Then Carmen came back to herself and to the room and felt the chair under her hams. The vision had left her more awake than she had been in months. Her senses were frighteningly keen. She could smell the rose bouquet from the back bedroom, and her eyesight was so sharp she noticed a minute whiskey stain on the carpet that even the impeccable signora had not spotted. But she was most stunned by her ears, which registered clearly the phone conversation in the kitchen, and by her crisp mind, which effortlessly understood every word of that language she had grown so weary of and no longer bothered to listen to. "No, Saturday is out. I've got that damn wedding to go to. You know, the foreman's getting married. Manuel? That's right. I was out at the ranch yesterday. I gave him a little bonus, you know, and he says to me, 'Señor Valdez, it would be an honor if you'd be our witness.' So I'm in for the whole works. He's got himself a picture bride from Mexico. She gets her Friday and the wedding Saturday. Olay! Oh, my God! He showed me her picture. Real excited about it, you know. She's got a round face like they do, but she's pretty enough now. Just wait, though. I tell you, in a few years, she'll be F-A-T like the rest of them. I mean F-A-T. Carmen picked herself up, untied her apron, and went out the back door. It was hot in the Valley of San Joaquin. Even in October, it was hot. It was a desert, in fact. As Carmen walked down the street, her white ballerina slippers turned gray with dust.
Es una casita muy linda y chiquita.
Al frente hay un sauce que llora, porque yo la quiero.
Si vas para Chile,
te ruego, viajero, le digas a ella
que de amor me muero. Si vas para Chile,
that was Kate McKnight reading Miss Carmen. And isn't it ironic and unexpected that Carmen, who was so able to deal with all the snobbishness and condescension of her bosses, Missy Walker and Senora Valdez, she somehow couldn't overcome her own desire, her hunger and appetite for that man, Manuel, whom she believed would be happy with her. So here now is Carmen, who never had any trouble communicating her own brand of honesty and candor to the high society ladies she met up with on a daily basis, now seemingly unable to find the words to tell Manuel about her feelings, so that he, as we heard, went out and sent away for a mail-order bride from Mexico. Thank you so much for your great story, Ann Marcella. Friends, as we told you at the beginning of the program, Ann Marcella grew up in Fresno. She graduated from Memorial High, later from Mills College, and then went to France where she received a master's in modern French letters from the University of Paris. We also want to congratulate her on the fact that recently one of her stories was nominated for a Pushcart Award, and that is quite an honor indeed. Of course, we hope that she has another story for us for next year. And so we come to the end of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for tuning in. If you want to listen to tonight's or any other of Valley Writers Read programs again, just go online at kvpr.org and link up with Archived Audio. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio, produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.